I'm Bruce Harold. I'm product manager for the Data Interoperability Extension. With me today is Dale Lutz, one of the co-owners of Safe Software, who engineered the extension for us. So some history here. A number of years back, Esri decided to get out of the game of general format support. There's some work we still continue to do in-house around CAD and for some purposes like real-time GIS around feeds and so forth. But by and large, our format support is engineered for us by Safe Software through the Data Interop extension. So you're here today to learn about some of the basic fundamental use cases and workflows of Data Interop. So without further ado, we will get into that.
Yes, so thanks, Bruce. So we're going to alternate back and forth. I'm going to be the sort of color commentator, and Bruce will do the exciting demos for us. And we'll walk through the basics of what this extension does for you. Now, I will mention that tomorrow morning, not in this room, but at the same time slot somewhere, we're doing an advanced data interop session, which is going to look at some of the more advanced uses. And so if you're interested and intrigued by what you saw today, please do come back tomorrow for that. I'll also mention that there's a couple other Safe Software people here, and we have a booth downstairs. They would have handed to you, many of you would have received an invitation. We do training for free at Safe, and the training we do for our core product called FME 100% applies to the Data Interop extension. So feel free to join. I think on July the 19th, we have a course on how to use it specifically with respect to moving data right in and out of GeoDatabase.
And in the showcase area itself, in the various halls it fills, we've done an excellent job of spreading all this information out across a vast distance. So at one end of the Geodata Island, there are the Data Interop specialists, where I'm not stationed to work. I'm working in the desktop area, which is right handy to their booth. So if you're either end of the hall, we have you covered.
Yes.
So you can drop into the Geodata area to learn about Data Interop extension itself, or talk to me in desktop area or one of the Safe crew in their booth right by desktop.
Yes. So without further ado, let's take a look. So what actually is this extension? Well, as Bruce mentioned, I've actually lost track. I think it's more than 10 years ago. We began at Safe 23 years ago, and almost immediately we started working with ESRI. Our lucky break, we're Canadian, which I think is why we're in room 33A. We very early got involved with a common client, which wasn't even an Esri client then, that wanted to use something called the Spatial Database Engine, or SDBE. This was back in 1994-95. Shortly after that, Esri bought the SDBE, and it became the SDE. And we found ourselves in the unlikely position of being two of about four people in the world that knew how to work with that thing. And so we began very early on to do importers and exporters for the SDE and helped Esri in a variety of projects. And that partnership continued until the time when we did a more formal relationship where they basically today sell almost an entire version of our flagship product branded as the Data Interop extension. So what it does today is work with literally hundreds of different data formats. The thing is that most of you will only ever care about three of them. The problem is you all care about a different three. But generally speaking, we've got you covered, and we deal with the changes in versions. So since we began, I think there's been roughly 20 different AutoCAD versions, and we have covered that all off. And if you began using our software 20 years ago to move AutoCAD files, the scripts or the configuration you created, which we call a workspace, would still work today. And so that's what one of the things we do for you. If you think that all we do is just move data between formats, you're shortchanging yourself, though. And by the end of this morning's demo, Bruce is going to show how important it is that as the data moves from A to B, you rearrange it so that it's useful and immediately ready to be efficiently made use of in the destination. And so that's really the key value of the product, and that's done by what we call setting up a transformation with Workbench. And when we say transformation, we mean manipulating the attributes. So if I'll pick on CAD. If I'm starting with an old-fashioned MicroStation file that has things on level 3 that are blue with a dashed line, some CAD technician somewhere set that up to mean that that's a logging road. And so when I get over into GIS, I would rather not have it say that that's supposed to be a blue dashed line on level 3. I would rather have that say that it's a logging road. So we give you tools to easily express these transformational rules, and then you set that up once, and then the idea is run it over and over again many, many times. So that was a CAD to GIS example, but the same thing works if you're going between let's say, a KML file and GeoDatabase, or you have to send GeoDatabase out to AutoCAD, and there's a very specific CAD standard you need to make, or different cloud formats, the reach is quite broad. So when we do this transformation, we're really competing against you writing Python scripts. And hopefully by the end of today, you'll see how you can be drastically more productive working within this environment than writing things from scratch. And in the long run, the maintenance issue also goes away. So that's why we say no coding required. In the modern times, a lot of our work relates around web services. There's an explosion of data out there behind a REST or a web API, and that is the modern format. The old CAD files haven't gone away. Everybody still uses them, but there's a whole new frontier where data is living, and that's where we continue to push as well. So there are three workflows we're going to highlight today. So the first one is the direct read of formats. And I should mention that today we're focusing on primarily the traditional ArcMap, ArcCatalog world. If you come back and see us tomorrow, we're going to be doing the whole thing. Bruce is going to do it with the not quite yet released.
Yeah, it's released.
It is released?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Oh, doesn't matter which version I'm using. I'm going to use Pro 1.3,
right.
But what I'm going to show you works in 1.2.
That's true. It does work. Mm-hmm. There's a brand refresh happened in 1.3, which you'll be able to get in a few days, and that's what we're going to be showing. Yeah. So
That'll be hitting web services.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. So we're going to directly read formats. So that was the original requirement. Let's be able to read a GML file straight into ArcGIS without translation. And so we're going to show you how that works. Then we're going to look at what we call quick translation. Look, here's a map info file. I just want it in ArcGIS. I don't ever want to care about that map info file again. Let's go click, click, and whatever was in the map info file, I'll get that type of workflow. And Bruce will show that can be done. And then lastly, we'll go where I think the key value lies, and that is in the so-called spatial ETL geoprocessing. These tools we create are like Python scripts in that they can plug into broader geoprocessing models and reused in that way. So why do people use the data interop? Often it is purchased because there is some original pain point. You have to receive data from your county and it's in the wrong system and you don't like it, and so you need to get rid of that pain. So you buy the data interop and you solve that initial problem. But very, very, very often people begin to realize, wait a minute, I can also solve this thing. And every day we need to prepare these summary reports, and this thing is really good at that. Oh, I need to get an Excel sheet out and it's styled in a certain way. Incidentally, the data interop does a spectacular job of creating custom Excel. People say that Excel is the shapefile of non-spatial data, and so we do a really good job of that. So you begin with a pain point, and then you start to see some of these other things. Change detection. I know, Bruce, you like the change detection. You going to show that today?
I am.
Look at that. So there you go. Automation. So you set up a workflow that you're going to run over and over again within a larger framework. Data integration. The data interop extension is spectacular at taking a file from, let's say, an Excel file, a CAD file, and a database. Let's merge them all together, rearrange it, and produce ourselves our wonderful geodatabase on the way out. And so it's really, really good at that. Data validation. I know it's shocking to many of you, but the world is filled with bad data. And so we provide a variety of tools that make it very easy to do checks. In fact, a lot of people use this tool not to go from A to B, but to go from A through a bunch of checks, and they hope nothing comes out because only the bad things come out. Those CAD guys gave you a file. You're going to make sure all the polygons close. If something doesn't close, you're going to output the loose lines back to CAD and give it back to those guys. If nothing comes out, you celebrate, the data is good, you can move on. So geometric validation as well as attribute validation is a common use. There's a Twitter account right now that some snarky person has set up called the shapefile or at shapefile. And he keeps basically he's searching for anybody that mentions shapefile on the internet or on Twitter and then replies in a snarky way. I saw yesterday he sent a tweet, or she, that the 100th follower just signed up and they said, congratulations at whoever, you're the 100th follower. You'll receive your PRJ file in your email shortly. So that was their prize. But the person also tweeted that if you're using shapefiles, you should geometrically validate your data 3 times and all your problems will go away. That was one of their things. And so we could do that with data interop. And lastly, distribute data. Very often many of you need to send data out to contractors or other government departments or others in your organization that don't use either the same data models or the same formats, and so this extension is really good at that. So Bruce has made this nice Wordle of all the different formats that we can work with that are common, and we can directly read. I'm going to just highlight a couple in here. Civil 3D, I know many of you would be working in environments where Civil 3D needs to be brought into ArcGIS. We can do a great job of that. We've worked closely with Esri to make that happen. When you look through here, you see all kinds of old formats and new. All the XML, GML things are very well supported. Things like GeoPackage, Esri does support those. We do as well within the data interop. Some of these, as Bruce mentioned, are done for other reasons by Esri, but they work together.
There's even Minecraft, but not for gaming.
That's right. It's actually a serious business producing Minecraft models. Dimitri from our office gave a lightning talk on Monday about it. And actually in Sweden and in a lot of European countries, it's become common to produce Minecraft models for the whole country or particular cities. And the U.S. Park Service is talking about producing some for the 100th anniversary of parks. We actually did Mount Rainier for them. It was pretty fun. And then we added a roller coaster down the side. It was really fun. And actually, we made it erupt, which was pretty fun, too. So all kinds of things, fun and serious, able to be done. So, Bruce, you want to take it away and show us how to read some things in our catalog?
I will. Thanks, Dale. So, generally, Esri, it's all about the map, right? And poor old Arc Catalog never has its time in the sun. Well, I happen to think that a lot of really, really good work gets done in Arc Catalog. And if you're a data wonk and you're using Data Interop, this is where you might do a lot of your heavy lifting. So here for direct read, what's the experience? I'm in a catalog tree here, obviously, and I can see something that looks like a featured dataset icon. If I click into it, I can see some geometry in there. It looks like a normal feature class. I can query it. I can, in fact, use it in geoprocessing, but it is a KML file, well, the compressed version, KMZ, KMZ for us people from the old empire. But it's just there on disk. You can use it like any other data source in your mapping, GP, and so forth. It's not just, though, features on disk. Here's another one here, which is all the earthquakes in the last week around the world. And that's a live feed coming from USGS, GeoJSON feed. Just looks like a local data source. Now, I made what's called an interoperability connection to that URL. That saves a little file with an extension FDL on disk. I moved it into my project workspace. And now anytime I want to do some geoprocessing mapping with a live feed, it's just there. No coding, no nothing. It's just a parameterized reach out to a web service, and I've got my data. No more stress. So just to show that that works everywhere we want it to, I've got a model here. I've used that earthquake feed. Oh, I've got to edit it. It's much more fun to edit these things, isn't it, than to just run them. So I run this guy here, and there's 201 quakes happened in the last week on that feed. So I just did some geoprocessing there with a live feed. Direct read, nothing to do, nothing to worry about. So there's a couple of small examples.
Okay. So just to recap that, to pull that off, I'm tethered here. To pull that off, Bruce had to first install and enable the Data Interop extension. Actually, I should mention that just by installing this, even if you don't buy it, you get direct read of some GML files in WFS. Isn't that right, Bruce?
Yep.
Yeah. So even if you don't want to use the rest, if you have to work with those things, that you get for free. But anyway, you install it, you enable it, and now you can start browsing to things, and we go by the file extension generally, or as Bruce mentioned, there is a node there in the catalog tree where you can make a specific connection, and you can go to a variety of different databases that way, as well as online feeds. Yes. And actually, when you make those connections, you can actually refine how FME is going to produce the data from them. So some of you, I know you can directly read without the Interop extension, you can directly read CAD files in ArcGIS. But if you want to, with the Data Interop, you can make a connection to a CAD file and then refine how that data is going to be displayed. So you can say, I want to see it by geometry, I want to see it by its layer inside of AutoCAD or level, or I wanted to fish out whatever attributes were in that CAD file and show it to me as if it was a GIS file. All those things can be done, some other ways of looking at CAD as well. Now, That was direct read. Great if you don't need to make a copy of the data. You just want to look at something and leave it where it was. It's a very non-invasive approach. But you may decide that you want to actually bring the data into ArcGIS. And now you find yourself at a fork in the road. You got two options. You can do what's called the quick imports or exports, or you can go for the more advanced ETL transformation. In the next second, we're going to show you the quick translation. So this basically says we give you two geoprocessing tools to quickly import to a geodatabase or export from a geodatabase. And so the idea is that it's quick. You don't have to really think about it. We will do our best to give you what we think is a reasonable guess as to how you would want that data to look when it's gone through the pipe. So for many formats, again, if I'm picking on map info, it'll come through and basically be good enough. Like there's map info was a reasonably similar kind of system to ArcGIS, and so bringing it in via quick is fine. On the other hand, if you're coming from a complicated XML format or even a CAD format, I would doubt that a quick would give you what you wanted. So there's pluses and minuses to that. Also going out, a lot of times when you're exporting out of ArcGIS, the quick is good enough because wherever you're going is probably structured in a way similar enough to ArcGIS that doing quick on the way out is fine. So Bruce, do you want to do some quick imports?
I'll do something quick. Okay, so in my little demo workspace here, I have copied in the system tools quick export and quick import, which Del was just talking about. They are available to you in the regular Arc Toolbox tree, of course. I've made a model up, which I'm going to now edit, and it uses a quick import tool. So that's a hint to you, you can use these quick data moves in automated scripted environments. And I'm doing something here, I'm going to select data. What am I going to select that for? Well, in the data I'm going to be working with, there may or may not be more than one geometry type. Mm-hmm. So if I'm only interested in, say, the polygon features in a format that's automatically recognized for me, those are the only features I want to take forward in my geoprocessing. So I'd select the data from the quick import to be only those features in the output workspace. So go back over here, edit this guy again. Come back you. And when I run the tool, it's a little bit different in the messaging that you see in the dialogue compared to a pure Esri core tool because the messaging is coming from the FME engine.
It's but got a Canadian accent.
It does. It speaks in tongues. But it says, okay, it succeeded, so it's all good news. If it didn't succeed, it would tell you, of course. And here I've got the City Parks polygon features from that select data. I don't want to say that again. And over there, that's exactly what I see. I've got the city parks. They're not very exciting data, but there you go. So if, however, I wanted to speak to the great unwashed who didn't have ArcGIS or the FME product itself, I might want to pump out something like a PDF. So I'm going to say, well, let's go and say quick export. I'm going to take that input layer. I've got to navigate to that. Excuse me while I get there.
I think, Bruce, I've heard it said that PDF is where data goes to die.
Well, it could be. Oh, look, here's another one of my favorite formats, null format.
That's great.
You can never make anything wrong.
You can't
wrong.
Go wrong well, going to null.
You cannot. I'm going to go out to Adobe Geospatial PDF. I'm going to write a file. That'll do. Again, you see the kind of quirky dialogue until you get used to it. Off it goes. It made a PDF file, which is not something we do an awful lot of. Internally in ArcGIS, and I can open it in Adobe Reader eventually.
Is it coming?
Oh, I don't know. What's going on there? Well, the demo detector has kicked in, and Adobe Reader is failing on us. I'm sorry to hear that.
Maybe during my next thing you can open it up and see. So I'm sure it's downloading an update.
It could be. Who knows? Sorry about that. Well, there you go. The best intentions get foiled by demo time. Okay. Anyway, that's a couple of quick movements of data from A to B. And yes, you can use this in Model Builder and anywhere else in geoprocessing and scripting.
There it is. Go back and see it?
Oh, yeah. I don't know why that was. There
it's
it is.
Pretty exciting.
Glorious PDF.
Actually, I think that the attributes are on those things too, aren't they, Bruce?
Yeah.
Somehow, if you figured out how to select them.
Yeah, I'd never go to.
I don't know.
Look at these things. You can make them far more interesting PDF files than what I do.
Yes, actually. So the quick just on PDF, if you have reasons to create those things, the quick one will give you something like Bruce just did. But if you use the thing we're about to show you, you can have very, very fine-grained control of exactly what goes in the PDF, and you can make little windows that have maps and all kinds of things like that. There's something called the PDF page formatter or some page layout.
There's a styler?
Yeah, there's a layout thing that lets you route data in. So if you live and die in PDF, you can do a pretty good job with that.
Well, it's a great sharing format. It's, yes. Again, like Excel.
Right. Just to kind of recap this, quick import and export, really fast, really easy, no fuss, no muss. The data will come in, however we made the best guess for you. So you're kind of trusting those crazy Canadians to do something reasonable, and we'll do our best. Very often, data will be left behind, because there may not be an obvious way to take the data from wherever it was and fit it into ArcGIS. When you get into the world of different formats, it's kind of like square pegs and round holes. A lot of times stuff doesn't quite line up. And even in Bruce's example, when we bring in map info data, in the case of map info, a single table can have any kind of geometry. So you can have points in there, lines, or polygons. So when we do a quick import, we always have to separate those out. So if it was called parks to begin with in map info, when we do a quick import to GeoDatabase, we're going to end up with parks underscore point, parks underscore line, parks underscore polygon. And we have to make that guess because we have to be able to separate that out. Even if there ends up being only polygons in there, it's going to still name it that parks underscore polygon because there's a chance that we might have had other ones. And so that's where the quickness, you have to live with our fact that we just have to make the best guess we can. If you don't like that, then you can go into the ETL tool that we're going to get into and then say, you know what, I know that it's only going to have polygons, so just name it parks already, and we won't worry about the other ones. But yeah, that's a good thing. So this whole transformation thing I keep hinting at is under the umbrella of what we call spatial ETL. And ETL is a term that comes from our database or DBA kinds of friends and stands for extract data out of somewhere, transform it, and then load it into somewhere else. And so these tools can go between anything and anything at the same time, and multiples of anything to multiples of anything. They don't have to end up in ArcGIS, a GeoDatabase. You can make an ETL tool that'll go from CAD to XML if that turns your crank. And so you could go also to many things at once. You could go from shape files to a file GeoDatabase as well as a GML file at the same time. Or very often a CAD file that goes to GeoDatabase and an Excel spreadsheet that has some kind of statistics about what's going on. These are all common kinds of operations. There is actually a new industry segment that our database friends have kind of created called data preparation tools, tools that help you prepare data for future work and analysis. And in many ways, the Data Interop extension is actually a spectacular data preparation tool. When we began our work in 1993, the commonly believed folklore was that for any GIS project, 80% of the time was spent gathering the data and getting it ready, and only 20% doing the real work. And our whole point was to squeeze that beginning 80% down to 10% so that you could spend 90% of the time actually doing what you wanted to do. In many ways, our whole objective with what we're doing by creating Data Interop and our main product, FME, is to have you not use it. We want it to be so fast and simple that you end up spending all your time doing the important work that we saw in the plenary session that desperately needs doing. And so that's what this is all about. So when we say transform, again, any number of sources and formats, you rearrange the schema. You can deal with interactions. Say, look, I only want things to come through where they touch each other in a certain way. I want to know all the bridges that touch roads, and if they don't touch a road, then I'm going to put them into an error file. These kind of topological things can be done. They're done one row or one feature at a time, and so that gives you a finer level of granularity than, say, Model Builder. So the two tools complement each other very well. Model Builder is great for working at whole tables at a time. Data Interop ETL tools work generally a row at a time and give you full control on individual rows. There's coordinate system transformations in there. Different styling things. If you're going to KML and you want to make sure that the bubbles look the certain way, there's tools to make that very, very easy. There's deep support for all kinds of expressions. You can actually embed Python as well if you want to get more advanced. We've done a lot of work making sure this supports both Portal and ArcGIS Online in really convenient ways. So if you have to be, I had somebody at the booth yesterday wanting to pull some data out of ArcGIS Online, do some changes in a batch way, and then push it back up, update the things in ArcGIS Online. All of that is very easily done.
And we find a lot of people wanting to synchronize web feature services from online or their portal to some other format.
Yep.
Regardless of whether or not sync editing is enabled on the feature service, you can do it with Data and Drop.
So I will mention, as Bruce gets into this, he's going to use a new tool. It's a new environment that you kind of have to get your mind around the mental model of this thing. Basically, data is going to come in from the left one row at a time, and you're going to draw a graph of where that data is going to go, and it's going to end up on the right-hand side in some destination, and it's going to go through a bunch of blue boxes that we call transformers. And so part of the magic and the power is knowing what transformers to use. And we recognize that this is a bit of a hurdle because there's many, many of them. They are very, very powerful, and like Lego blocks, you can rearrange them in unique ways. If you stop by our booth, we'll give you a catalog of these. This catalog is very popular, and then you can flip through that to get a quick understanding of the scope of what's available to you. There's blue boxes in there for doing things with LiDAR. That's what we'll talk about tomorrow, for doing things with 3D data, for doing all kinds of attribute manipulations and styling and so on. And so as Bruce goes through his examples, we'll be looking at that. So Bruce, take it away. Show us how to work the magic.
Okay, so we're good here. So I'm in a new workspace and catalog here. If I can just find where my mouse is. And there's a shapefile there. Okay, well, that's the world's most popular
format. I will say, according to our usage stats, 50% of all of the data that moves through the Data Interop and FME, our main product, mm-hmm. is either coming or going to Shape. So despite the fact that there's 300 and some formats, you all love Shape.
Yeah,
so
I can't
it's good you're doing
out.
A Shape demo.
Yep, I know. We've got to go there. So I've opened up, looked inside a toolbox, and what's this thing in here? It is the spatial ETL tool. So the icon for that thing is a little bit different to a script tool or a core geoprocessing tool. If I edit this guy, I get the environment that Dale has been talking about. Now, it's actually a different application. It starts a new process, and the application is called Workbench. So the analogies with Model Builder that Dale was kind of talking to a little bit are that it's a graphical programming environment, so no coding. That's the same as Model Builder. The difference is that if it can, it'll work a feature at a time, not a feature data set or feature class at a time. So from left to right, so there's some panes like ArcGIS Pro or ArcMap or our own applications. There's panes that do things. I can move around, but it gets dangerous if I mess with these things. I told you, don't do that. Go away, come back. Okay, all's forgiven. Never go off-road when you're demonstrating. I can navigate my workspace, and here I can go down here, and here's the feature types. If I navigated into that guy there, it would say, there it is. So that's how I can navigate my workspace if it got big and ugly. There are other ways to do that too. But in the middle here is the canvas where all my work is happening. So I'm reading these features on the side here. They are the shapefile that we saw in catalog. I'm doing stuff with them. I suppose I could zoom in a little bit more so you could see it a bit better. But it's like learning German. The words are sensibly named if you squeeze them together, if they're describing something. So the attribute namer does, guess what? It renames attributes. So there's sense in the naming of the transformers, so they're not that hard to learn. So what's in and what's going out, including case sensitivity, is there. String concatenator does what you suspect. A little bit busier user dialogue there, but it squeezes some words together with spaces or commas or whatever you did, wanted to. Then we forking the data here. So the data can go down one of two, and actually both.
Actually, those will go
to both. So yeah. There's no logical filtering going on. It'll go down both routes. So what's the point here? What's going on? The attribute filter lets me output in separate streams the data that matches attributes values for the value of the attribute called program. The features will go out each of these different connectors. And they are going to be written to a FileGear database that's going to be created as these feature classes, called these kind of crazy names, and they're point feature classes. And so all there could be any geometry. So that's one way to do that, and it's a common requirement that you want to make separate feature classes from some single source or combination of sources. that's not as efficient as doing it like this, which, and so I've dimmed these guys out, I've disabled them. I could enable, but I don't really want to write things that way. I want to do it like this and write multiple feature classes with one writer. So this other amber-colored guy at the side here is a writer as opposed to a reader. And I'm going to write out the name of the feature class is the value of the program attribute. So let's run everything here, and we'll see what happens.
So you're going to get a separate table for every value of that attribute, and all the guys that share that value will be shacked up together in the same table.
They will. So helpfully, there's some numbers appeared on these connectors. Those are the number of features that went through that particular connector. So, and they do this in real time. So you can entertain yourself by watching your data flow around the workspace and just check where it's going. And you can do fancy things like enable inspection on these connections. So if you want to see what they look like as they're going through, pause them, do like step in, step out stuff if you're a developer. It's there for you, and no coding required. So that wasn't hard, was it? So I wrote 15-somethings to this amber guy. What did it make? I'll go here. And if I refresh this, I can see the database is made, and I got those points out, whatever those are. I don't even know what they are. But that's the point here. We made a file geodatabase, and we made separate feature classes with one writer. So that's an efficient and simple ETL. We saw the transformation of attribute renaming. There's a couple other ones that went on in there. No coding, just works.
Excellent.
So does that hit the points there?
Yeah. I think so.
Oh, great.
That's great, Bruce. Whoops. So, yeah, so you saw that, and hopefully the ease at which he was able to create all those different tables might whet your appetite as to how you could solve a set of problems. We call that a fan-out kind of problem, where you want to filter and explode out to different things. Very, very common type of scenario. So again, just to recap that, you have a different application within the environment called Workbench that lets you create spatial ETL tools that live as geoprocessing tools in a toolbox. And actually, you can parameterize these as well within Workbench so that within geoprocessing, you can run them later, ask somebody what's the input file you want to run, what's the tolerance, what's the label title you want, and then those parameters will be fed in and they'll do their thing. And as this arrow indicates, the data moves generally from the left to the right, following these lines as we connect the data flows left to right.
And green is good.
Green is good. If stuff is red, then that means that there's nothing connected or basically no value is going to go there. You're going to get nulls. And yellow within this environment on these ports just means, you know, it probably is okay, but you've never really said anything and we're going to do our best guess here. So yellow is kind of like, well, it might be good, might not be, but we're not going to stress. So another example use case that Bruce is going to set up for us is a great data integration where we're going to combine an Excel spreadsheet, some GML data. That's a little tip of the hat to our friends from Europe, probably. I don't think Americans generally have GML data. Anybody in here use GML ever? Nobody that'll admit to it? So anyway, which is sad because we've spent enormous amounts of effort on this, but it's very, very popular in Europe. It's an XML fest of formats, really. There's many of them. And then you've got a good old-fashioned AutoCAD file that we're going to bring in at the same time. We're going to make ourselves a KML, and you're actually going to fire up ArcGIS
Earth, yeah.
Yeah, okay.
The latest version.
Whoops. So, should we do that demo?
I don't know. What does it say? Say demo?
Well, if I do the next one, it's... Do you want me to talk about...
Yeah, we could do the
demo. I think we'll flip through and do this.
We'll do the demo.
Yeah.
So here we are back in catalog. I can see I've got map info interchange format file, a KML file, a GML file, which they're all but bad mouth, but it really is quite versatile. And I've got another ETL tool here in my toolbox. It's going to integrate nest and egg data.
Ah, the famous birds and eggs.
Yeah, the birds and eggs. This is hatching happening in Texas.
Yeah.
Okay, so here we go, the Workbench application. So we have a blizzard of formats going in and out. Well, it's not too bad. There's only two different formats in and two out.
Can you zoom in, Bruce?
Yeah, I can do that. Can we see better?
There we go.
Okay. So I'm reading City Parks GML. So GML is from the open source community mindset, and it's a sharing format. It's leveraged in some other child formats of GML, which tend to get names like this ML and that ML. Anyway, there we're getting GML, and we're using a styler. So a styler is something you won't find in an environment like Model Builder. Feature classes have no idea if they're supposed to be green. But you can, if you're writing to a format that understands styling, then you can do the styling in this kind of geoprocessing environment. So if something's being turned green, there's another property being set. It is a text property. And so when you're writing out to the KML file with the parks, they're going to be green, they're going to have a label. And the bird nest points inside the parks, hopefully, they get some styling done too. They get an icon picked up from a URL. Wow. So it's worth saying that in keeping with the world, not everything you've got is on your disk,
yes.
Right? So you can reach out to a URL for not just things you typically get from a URL, like an image that gets fed to you by 64-bit encoded nonsense that you never saw or would read, but you can reach out and get files. So if you wanted a zipped file geodatabase that somebody was sharing on an FTP site, it's just the URL as the parameter there, and the system will reach out and get it for you. You don't have to worry about HTTP GET and other things like this. Some other property is set in the KML file that's read. The nests are going to be input there as well. Now, something funny going on here, I'm doing a database join, and that's reaching out to a CSV file, which is somewhere, happens to be on disk here. CSV is just text, comma-separated values. It's the world's worst database, Mimic. It's seldom typed properly. I hate it. Right up there with shapefile, and that's one of our own formats. And there we go, joining in some data from CSV to an Excel spreadsheet. Like KML, a very popular sharing format. So let's run this guy here and see what happens. I'll just see what happens. This time a bunch more features got written. See, there's some red here, but I know not to worry about the red because it's just the population of KML format attributes. So not all red is a killer or a showstopper. Some red can be let go. Some good green down here. So what happened? This thing made some data. I can see it here because I've enabled, the extension enables visibility of these formats. But the fun one that it made is this guy here, KML files, I'm going to share with the other, what are they called, twitchers, the bird fanciers. Here we are, opened ArcGIS Earth. The styling made the packs go green, which is kind of not apparent until I change the base map. The packs right. Are indeed green, and that URL that was reached out to grab an image for a bird's nest, it got a little birdie there, and there's the attribution that came through. All is good. So with no pain, I've reached out to a couple of non-native formats, and I've written a couple of non-native formats to ArcGIS. So I think that hits the points yep. of integrate multiple formats. So we'll go back to Dale, yep. number three.
And, Bruce mentioned about how we can reach out with the data interop extension to data living at a URL. So if there's a zip file or a single zip file of shape files or something like that at a URL, you can just put that as the data set and it'll read that. Where we're going with the next version of data interop, well in the future, you'll be able to reach out to a file sitting on Google Drive, Dropbox, OneDrive, all these Amazon S3, all these places in the cloud where data is tending to live now. I long ago used to say that data only lives on people's networks. Files are only local, and that's very quickly no longer being true. Data is living out there in the cloud, and the amount of stuff that's actually just locally on your C drive is getting less and less and less as time goes on. So another type of integration like this could be going to PostGIS as an output. Or, Bruce, what was this symbol mean there? You had a name for that.
ArcGIS platform.
That's the ArcGIS platform, and this would be just a standard database of
database
any kind.
Can.
So you can do these kinds of things. And actually, I had Bruce do the demo already, so we'll skip that. So those were data integration examples. Now we can talk about a very common use case, which is a data migration case. In fact, we had somebody come by our booth yesterday that was very interested in doing a migration from Small World into ArcGIS. And that's a serious one-time kind of data move that a lot of elbow grease is going to need to be put in to get those schemas, all the bits of data that's in Small World, exactly fitting into the right spot in ArcGIS. So that's kind of a high-end migration. CAD to GIS would be a kind of a more common kind of migration. And as Bruce points out on this slide, very often now we're seeing people migrating between things that are locally on-premises or up in the cloud. And that is a different kind of data move and migration. And key to all of this, we feel, is the ability to finally control if you're doing inserts, deletes, updates. Because very often in these migration situations, people are trying to keep systems synchronized. And that can all be done with the extension. This becomes a little more of an advanced case, but it can be done. Data validation is another common one I mentioned at the beginning. And there's some key transformers available. One is called a tester, which lets you write kind of an arbitrary test. And if the row passes that, it goes out the pass port. If it fails, it goes out the failed port. If any of you come from a programming background, there's also a concept of a switch statement or a case statement inside of data interop. And that's called the test filter. So you write a series of logical expressions, and the first one that's matched, the feature goes out there. So that can be very common and or very handy to filter data around. Geometric validation. If you want to make sure that the data you're bringing in from, let's pick on CAD, actually is proper polygons that don't self-intersect, or they are of a certain length, or they don't have repeated nodes, you can do tests in a geometry validator about that. And in fact, if you want us to, we can give a crack at repairing them. So if it's a kind of geometric problem that is recoverable easy enough, you can engage this thing to try to repair, and it'll do its best to repair. So that can be happy as well. So those would be those things. So Bruce, you're going to do some validation.
I'm going to do some validation.
Okay, great.
So as Dell was saying, migration of external systems through to the ArcGIS platform, it really matters that it gets done right. I'll never forget I got my first gray hair on a data migration project to ArcGIS. It was ArcInfo back in the day, because the manager of the system, of the company we were working for, they really cared that everything got through. There was to be no loss. Everything had to be perfect. And everybody thinks their data is perfect, but trust me, it's not. I'm sure Dale has his own horror stories.
Nobody knows the troubles I've seen.
I bet. So we have a couple of AutoCAD drawings here. I do not know where their provenance, and I've got an ETL tool that I'm going to show to do my QA reporting. So the scenario here is I'm getting some data over which I have no control, but over which I have a great deal of suspicion, and I'm going to do my best to report back to the data owner what they've got to fix. I'm going to do it in the nicest possible way, give them something they can always understand and share, which is going to be an Excel spreadsheet. So here's an AutoCAD drawing coming in. Now, these things here are new to you. That's a bookmark here, this big box around some of the other transformers. All that lets me do is visually label, and as you can see in the UI experience, move, if I want to, some transformers. So here some forking is going on. I'll just zoom in a bit more so you can read that a bit better. There's some geometry validation going on, so the dialogues get busy if you dig in, but just don't worry about them. We're checking if the geometry is any good. If it's good, we do some other test. Let's not care about that now. If it's some other test failed, we go out of here. Got errors. Okay, so this green thing here, this is a little bit of a peek into a slightly more advanced workflow. One of the things you can do if you select a bunch of transformers is basically collapse them into a single transformer, which gets pushed behind the scenes for you, so it declutters your workspace. So that is called a custom transformer. They are not lost. They are back here if we want to go back and deal with them. But so those green transformers are just transformers. They've just been made a bit more efficient for you. So there's no failures. You don't really want to write anything out. They just get some kind of notice gets pushed to the log file. The log file is important. It gets persisted by ArcGIS and your metadata and your history. So in your work, even if you don't write something out, it's never a bad idea to log some kind of message. However, if there were errors, what are we going to do? So without digging too much into the what's happening here with some testing, I've asked the user if they want to have a background map to show the error from Esri or from Google. This is an Esri show, so we're going to use Esri maps. This transformer here goes to ArcGIS Online and grabs a snapshot of a base map and grabs it as an image. And that's going to be pushed as a background to an Excel cell.
Wow, you're going to put an image in a cell.
We'll put an image in a cell.
You're going to show that?
I'm going to show that.
Wow, that's
so
amazing.
I'll go out to the, we'll see, we'll run this thing and see how we do. all data is fundamentally bad. So stuff is held up here. What's happening? We're waiting for it to get processed by ArcGIS Online. You can see some URLs flying out the door. If we're lucky, we're going to get some images back. I can't remember how many get processed. Here they go. They come back. I guess that's an asynchronous experience.
It must be.
There.
I didn't
know that. So 57 rows got written to this Excel spreadsheet. Now, I think I can quit this workspace now. So over here, if I refreshed, hello, I've got an Excel spreadsheet has arrived. Here it is on disk. Let's open it up. And what that workspace did is generate this file. And if we read here, each of these cells, is the invalid attribute is diameter. Here's a picture of where it is. So going down, there's a bit of a challenge here because of the screen resolution I have to use. But there's one row per error. The identifier is there for the feature, some other kind of code. The error that we found is here. Invalid diameter seems to be pretty common. And there's a little tiny map thing there which will let the users identify where this thing is back in their GIS, and it'll go back in the mix for correction. So there is a validation and output QA report scenario. And so how hard was that? You can do this too back in your office. Write Excel, KML, and cute little map chips. I think that transformers will download on your store.
Yeah.
We'll get it to you if you can't find it.
Impress your friends.
Yeah, exactly. Confuse them. Say, how did you become such a power user in Excel? Well, that's for you to know.
Okay.
So there we go.
So anyway, that gives you a sense of how easy it is to start integrating data from a bunch of places. In this case, looking at some of the services from ArcGIS Online that can be easily worked into these workflows to provide, hopefully, very convenient outputs for particular audiences. In this case, we'd be sending it to somebody who wouldn't be a GIS person. They're probably a CAD person and maybe field manager. They're going to have to send out people to do some work. We're looking at expanding this kind of reach. So the example that Bruce just did, perhaps a year from now, you'll come and see us, and Bruce will show you how every one of those things that was a row in the spreadsheet would instead be a Trello card, for example, if you know Trello, an online service for to-do lists. We could create Trello cards with little map chips in them and then assign that to somebody, a field worker, to go out and check them off.
Yeah, you can tweet now. You can email later.
You could tweet everybody when there's something wrong, although I don't know that would be a popular thing to do. But
send it to the shapefile Twitter.
So another great example that we'll touch on is change detection. And we've seen people doing this since almost the beginning of our work, where they're saying, I've got some original data, and then I've gone and made some changes, and now I want to compare that and apply those changes to ArcGIS. I can make versions with them, or I can do various types of updates with them. And so it's more common when you're working with stuff that isn't in the GIS environment to begin with. So there's CAD people out there, they're changing their CAD files, and you need to harvest the changes and put them into your GIS. And that's a type of thing. Or they're working basically with something in an unmanaged environment.
Yeah, this is also a new word, buzzword for today, conflation. If you have two data sources that may at some point have been one, they forked into different managerial environments. You've got to bring them back together but not duplicate features. Then change detection between those two data sets can be done in a couple of different ways with this extension.
Yeah.
And bring them back together and all will be well.
Yeah. So anyway, Bruce, are you ready to demo that?
Oh, yes. Thank you.
This is exciting. I love the change detector.
Change detector. Yeah, the naming. There's no mystery to the naming scheme for the transformers. So I have helpfully named my ETL tool detect changes. The scenario is, you can see that such a powerful transformer just needs no others. Zoom in. I'm terrible at this.
There you go.
Yeah, I'm right here, you see. I can see it just fine. So I have dog parks old. So these are dog exercise parks.
Can you teach an old dog park a new trick?
I don't know. You can give it a new name. That's what we're going to find here. So dog exercise parks in Vancouver, BC, there's a snapshot of them. Went out as a shapefile and got tweeted about probably. dog parks revised. The local government has done some work to add some dog parks or delete them or move them, whatever it happens to be. So we have those as readers. The old ones go into the original input port for this transformer. The revised one, the new ones, go into the revised port. And we detect changes. Now, a word on how to implement CRUD operations in databases. So back at the start of the talk, Dale talked about how he was one of the early adopters of the spatial database engine technology that Esri invested in. And its method of handling versioning and edits is to have adds and deletes tables. Whereas many databases want you to talk about inserts and updates and deletes. So there's a gap there. What's an update? Well, it's an add and a delete in SDE terms, or that way of thinking terms. In a feature service, we don't want to know about adds and deletes. We want to know about updates as well as adds and deletes. They're handled separately. So sometimes you might have to do some logic to turn your adds and deletes into updates and inserts and deletes. Sometimes you don't. So in this case here, I'm quite happy to leave it as the default output from the change detector as unchanged adds and deletes. Was I working with a feature service, I would not have that luxury. So let's see how busy the dialogue is. What can we change or detect changes in? 2D geometry, 3D geometry, full or none? Well, how does that help, Dale? I don't know, but I'm going to stick with 2D. And lenient geometry matching, what does that mean? If I was checking changes between road center lines, do I care which direction the line was digitized? If I don't, then I'd say lenient, yes. If I really cared about that, because it affects, say, something, how something is labeled up or down, then I would say not lenient, I'd say, which is strict. Match selected attributes, there's options there, all or none or neither. I pick the attributes coming in. I care about all of them because they all mean something. And do I care about the difference between empty, missing, and null? Another bane of databases and format handling is there is a difference between a space character, the number zero, the null value, and so forth, especially when they're counting them and doing statistics. So there's very rich handling of the concept of nullness in the extension. And Dale has a joke that he had a programmer working on nothing for 2 years. And this is the reason, because null is important.
The Seinfeld of safe software.
I know, yeah. You have to have fun at work. So here we go. Some 66 features went in, and they got split according to those tests that we just investigated, and they got sent out to a shapefile output. So it's not exactly... and we have a few minutes, so I'll open up a map document. So the I could look at them in catalog, but for once I'll go back to the... our mapping product, and it just will read the data that got replaced there. Unhelpfully, the city of Vancouver didn't make all their dog park updates in a condensed area. They got spread all over town, but we will get there because we've got a few minutes. So that's change detection. Like I said, a lot of people want to synchronize hosted feature services in ArcGIS Online with anything. Could even be a shapefile, and you can do it this way. So I've colored the three feature classes, as you can see, added and deleted and so forth. Zoom to layer. Where's one added that's up here behind? There's one hiding behind a label. There it is. I'll get to it. So there we go. There's a new one downtown. I guess that's where the rich people are going to walk their dogs, the Devonian Harbour Dog Park. It's unhelpfully labelled with some funky attribution, which we're not responsible for. It's his neck of the woods. So there you go, a nice, powerful brute force change detection. So no using GUIDs or anything fancy like that, although you could use that as an attribute. It's not automated by ArcGIS. It has to be done by brute force, then we have a way for you to do it.
Good.
So we're 5 minutes ahead of time, Dale.
That's good. You can tell more stories here as we wrap up.
Yeah. So we've got to change.
Right. I'm going to put Laura on the spot, or Candace. It feels to me like there's another transformer that if you know you have a key attribute, that will tell you the updates. And I can't remember
matcher.
What it's... Matcher. Does the matcher do that? Or is there a... Is it called an update detector? Yeah, that if you know that there was like an ID, the parcel ID, then you can give that change detector that information, and so then it can know, okay, if it has the same parcel ID, but there is a difference, then that was an update, as opposed to a delete and an add. So that we do that as well. So just some last things about automation. All the things that Bruce showed can be run as geoprocessing tools. You can parameterize them so that they would pop up with different parameters to fill in, and then you can use them inside of Python scripts. You can run them with Model Builder. You can publish them to ArcGIS Server as geoprocessing tools to be run up there as well. And so that's a set of things that can be done with that. We also can... in terms of what's coming, in terms of the ArcGIS Pro side of things, the last set of things that you saw here today, all of the spatial ETL tool stuff, that is what the integration with ArcGIS Pro is. So in ArcGIS Pro, there is no longer a direct read type of concept, so you'd need to use a tool to bring it into a format that Pro can read, and then off you go from that.
That may come, however.
It may come later, but at this point, that's what we got. Mm-hmm. And the other thing we didn't actually say is, what is the relationship between Safe Software's FME product and the data interop? The answer is the data interop is nearly a complete subset of FME, and it lags only slightly behind in terms of release. At Safe, we release every year in January-ish, and then an update kind of in the March, April timeframe. And we synchronize that as closely as we can with the data interop releases. So this year, our 2016.0 release is part of 10.4.1. Is that right?
Yep.
And the 2016.1 release is part of...
Well, it's 1.3. Out now in Pro... I keep on thinking Pro 1.3 is out, but it's in a week or two.
Yes.
So it's all but... the FME 2016.1.1 engine will be in Pro 1.3
right.
Coming very shortly.
And so we work hard to keep those synchronized and fully supported on the ESRI side. So I just would say, you know, as you've seen Bruce show these things, I hope you've seen the power that's available to you and how quickly these types of solutions can be made. But I do appreciate that there is a learning curve. And so that's why we've made our training available for free forever at SAFE. Not quite forever, but the last many years. And so you are welcome. You should have received from Candice and Laura on the way in an invitation to come to our geodatabase and FME/data interop training, which would be in July. But I also was super thrilled by the announcement at the plenary this week that all the virtual campus courses are going to be available for free. We've had for a long time an introduction to data interop in there, as well as an advanced one that we will refresh soon as well. And those are available to you as well. And they would take you by the hand and get you going so that by the end you're able to create the kinds of things that Bruce was showing. So there's resources like that available to you. Between SAFE and Esri, we try very hard to make available a lot of resources. There's also a website called knowledge.safe.com, which has a community discussion on the kinds of things you saw here, as well as in-depth articles. And Candice, what's your favorite article in the Knowledge Center? There's a whole page on what versions work with what kinds of ArcGIS. We recently dropped 10.0, I think, but we support way back into the past, and so we have detailed information like that. So here's a bunch of URLs. Bruce, these slides are available afterwards, I think.
Yeah, I'm not quite sure of the delivery mechanism, but these things are available.
Yeah, or come by the SAFE booth or check out, talk to Bruce and I, and we can give you pointers as to where you can find things. But in general, again, I would go to the virtual campus and look at the data interop courses there, as well as the free stuff that SAFE has available. And so I think with that, we'll ask if there's questions.
Yeah, we will. And come tomorrow, too, for our advanced training.
Yeah. Okay, so scheduling it, let's think, within the ArcGIS environment, how would you schedule that?
You write out your tool as a Python script. So we didn't highlight this, but every spatial ETL tool is callable as a normal geoprocessing tool. Right. It has a name, a label. You just use it in Python code. You can easily see it, give it its parameters. It'll just work the same as any other tool.
Yeah.
And then you would make, with your operating system, a scheduled task that ran on the interval you wanted.
Right. And so I will mention that SAFE itself, within our product stack, we have something we call FME Server, which is all about running these things by schedule or in response to actions that happen, like an email arrives and then it starts up. So that's an automation side there. But the people on desktops typically do it via schedules,
mm-hmm.
like the so-called Windows tasks.
Right. If it's not, you want to do it on your machine, use the operating system. You do it some other way on server environments.
Yeah. Very, very common. I like to say every night in Calgary, Alberta has the biggest concentration of our product anywhere in the world. And every night at about midnight, all the software wakes up and starts grinding all the well and exploration data for that evening. And it's done by 5 in the morning for people to do their work. But an enormous amount of data transformation happens overnight at these places. Any other questions?
I can tell a story. So recently I helped a financial institution who was stressing out over how to ingest USGS earthquake feed data into their, what do you call it, what do insurance companies do? They have these special names. Yeah, this is basically assessing risk and stuff like this. And they were thinking they're going to hire developers and plugins and messaging queues and all this sort of stuff. I said, no. What the feeds do you want? So I give them the FTL file. I said, stick that in the GP tool and run it as a scheduled task every 5 minutes. Oh, okay. So that's good. Well, it's not good if you are going to be the developer who's going to be hired, but it's good for me, right? Because I get to sell another copy of data and drop, and he gets a cut.
Yeah.
So do evangelize your knowledge in your organizations. You'll find a lot of cases where you can do some clever stuff with no pain.
Actually, I'll tell a story too. Since we recently were in Germany at our gathering there, and the European Environment Agency is a huge user of this technology. And the leader began using it about 4 years ago, and he had an army of people there, army meaning 10-ish, that were all developer Python scripters. And one of his big issues was they were having this huge legacy problem of all these Python scripts that the person who wrote it would understand, but everybody else would have troubles maintaining. And the graphical artifacts that you create with Workbench are just easier to wrap your mind around if you got to come back later. And so some of the big hurdle of introducing this technology generally into an environment is that people that like to program don't like to use this because, hey, they like to program. And so what this guy at the European Environment Agency said was, he said to them, okay, we're going to be doing all of our data imports now with this new tool. And a bunch of these guys said, several of them said, well, no, we don't want to do that. We want to program. And he said, that's great, because we're going to need people to maintain all those old scripts that we've been making for the last 10 years. And so I'm so glad that you want to keep doing that, because we really need you to do that while the rest of the team is going to go ahead and do all the new stuff over with this. After 2 days, they said, you know, maybe we'll learn this thing after all. But the maintenance issue for moving data is a serious one. And if you are creating lots and lots of scripts, those do have a maintenance baggage that comes with them. And so one of the big advantages is to do it with this way. What I'd say is that when this technology is a fit and is a win, it is like an outrageous win. We routinely get people telling us that they save hundreds of hours by employing this stuff. But sometimes it's not a good fit, and then it's bad news. So like any tool, I'm not going to tell you that's the solution to every problem, but when it is the solution to a problem, it is a big, big win. And so please don't be afraid to reach out to Bruce, to the Esri support folks, or the SAFE to help you figure out, is it appropriate for this situation or not? And we'd be pleased to give guidance on that.
I was thinking of actuaries.
Actuaries. Yeah, okay, that's a good thing.
I'll get set, right?
I know there's a whole, they touched on the plenary about reinsuring.
So this lady has a question.
Are you finding people were able to replace SQL Server SSIS?
Yes. SSIS, first of all, didn't do anything spatial, but I often say that we could throw away 75% of what's in the data interop, all the spatial stuff, and sell it for 10 times more, and it would just do the non-spatial stuff that people in it, that use SSIS or some of those other tools would do. So yes, it completely is, in fact, in a lot of ways, a more flexible replacement for things like SSIS. If some of you have heard of Alteryx, we've got customers that replace Alteryx with this as well because it's a fraction of the cost. And again, it doesn't do everything that Alteryx does, but the things that we do at least as well as for a fraction of the price. So, yeah.
Good.
All right. Well, hopefully, if this tweaked your interest, come by and see us down on the floor. Candace, our booth is like 40-something? It's 19-something.
It's the back of the hole.
We're at the very, very back where you'll never wander by accidentally. So, what's that? And we're right by Bruce where you'll also never wander by accidentally. But there's a big sort of learning lab right beside us. And tech support is kind of behind us.
Yeah.
So come by there or come see us tomorrow at 8:30. We're going to talk about, what's the topics tomorrow? Point cloud stuff?
Yeah, a lot of point cloud.
Do you do some Minecraft?
I do. Actually, you're going to.
Okay, whoops. Yeah. And what else? Maybe some raster things? I don't remember.
Yeah, we're going to colorize LiDAR with an orthophoto and fun stuff like that.
Right, right. Mm. So
we're going to reproject LiDAR. You can't do that in the rest of ArcGIS.
Right.
So.
Yeah. All right. Thank you so much.
Thank you.